British police authorities. I can't remember them directly asking me about it, though. But as you say, I'm sure it would have been done.
Did you think at all of other destinations apart from Australia?
Not really. As I say, I had that flirting idea about going to South Africa, which just never got off the ground. I was obviously influenced in the thinking about Australia by my mates at school and by what we'd learned about the place at school. The other place we learned a lot about, of course, again, being a Dominion country, was Canada. But I never thought about going to Canada. I think my view of Canada was that the place is just too bloody cold. I don't like the cold. And that was a shock to the system when I got here, of course, because there are parts of Australia which are extremely cold, and you just never, you know, from that distance, you never think of Australia as being cold at all.
How did your brother react?
Yeah, no, by this stage, he was living in the north of England. He was, you know, he was doing his own thing. He was tied up with rock bands. We saw each other not all that frequently, but we were still great mates and close brothers. He thought it was a good idea as well, because he wasn't doing very well for himself anyway. But there was no, you know, we weren't that close that, you know, you sort of hug each other as you say goodbye. I can't actually remember physically seeing him for the last time before I left. I don't know whether I did or whether I just spoke to him on the phone and said, mate, I'm off tomorrow. And he said, well, all the best, you know, keep in touch and good luck. We wrote to each other. We still write to each other regularly. But that's an interesting question. I cannot remember actually seeing him for the last time. One of the last times I saw him, but it certainly wasn't the last. he was a pretty good guitarist, and I was, again, being 5 years younger. I was at the age where I thought, well, if he can play a guitar, I want to too. And I said to him, look, you know, I want to learn the guitar. And he got out a piece of paper and he just drew the lines of the six chord, you know, the six strings of guitar, and wrote down nine chords and said, learn to play those, get your rhythm going, all right, you'll be able to play just about any song you want. And he said, it won't be brilliant, but it's just rhythm. And I did that, and that's probably the greatest gift he gave me, because I enjoy music and I've had a lot of fun out of it over the years. But that was very much down to Stephen.
And that started in England?
Yeah. By the time I got here, I couldn't play a guitar at all, hardly, you know. I mean, I was just slowly trying to get used to the chord sequences, and I didn't have a guitar. But I kept that bit of paper, nonetheless, and in years to come, I took his advice.
you were fairly young, weren't you, to leave on your own? Were you literally on your own?
Mm.
Yeah.
I was, and I can't recall that there was anybody else on that boat there were certain people on their own, but there was nobody on their own of my age. They were mid-20s. I was 18, and I had, you know, 18 and a half anyway, and the guys in the cabin that I was, there were four of us in a cabin, we were on C deck. This boat was a converted Italian troop carrier. A lot of the boats were converted, or had been converted, from liners into troop carriers and back to liners again. And it wasn't huge. I'm not sure how many passengers it would have had in all, probably around 700 or something like that. Mostly families, and just a few who were single travellers. And as I say, there were four of us in this cabin on C deck. And if it wasn't below the waterline, it was on the waterline. And it was tiny. It was a dog box. There was literally just two up and down bunks on each wall. There was one tiny little cupboard at one end of the room, in which we all had to, we all had to share to put things. Basically, we lived out of our suitcases that were under the bunks. I mean, the big trunk was in the hold, and I had one little sort of suitcase. But these guys were all mid to late 20s. They were good guys. They were great blokes, actually. They sort of looked after me, and because I was that much younger. I can't remember any of their names. We literally got off at the other end, went our own ways, and what happened to them, I don't know, and they probably don't know what happened to me either. But in a way, that's the way life goes, I suppose. But yeah, they were good blokes. We had fun on the boat.
I'm keen to ask more about the voyage, but just one more question about Australia. You clearly would have learned a bit about Australia from your two school friends, and also, of course, the official consular information that was given to you.
Mm.
Were there any other sources of information about Australia? And school, of course, you mentioned. But
no, not really. Not really, and even the two mates. I mean, we didn't have deep conversations about Australia and what it was and all the rest of it. These two guys had Australian accents. That was about it. You know, they were Australians, and that was sort of it. And of course, you know, we talked about the style of life over here and how it differed from what it was like in England, how they found England and things like that. But beyond that, and yeah, the information that the consul gave us, which was the standard sort of government handout stuff, if you like. What I'd learned at school, and I just pored over maps of Australia. Got maps of Australia and looked at them and studied the rivers and the towns and the things like that, you know, because we didn't have the internet or anything in those days where you could just Google something and see how big a town was, you know. It was there wasn't that immediacy of information.
I was thinking perhaps of films or television programs.
No, I hadn't seen anything that I recall as being totally Australian. My biology master at school, just before I left, because I'd actually sort of got to the point of the decision had been made that I was going to migrate before I finally left school, late in 65. My biology master was an interesting bloke. His name was Elwick. He went on to become a biology master at Eton, not long after I'd left. But he gave me a copy of Alan Moorhead's Cooper's Creek, and said, "There you go, boy. Read this." Which I did, and I found it a fascinating book, and that certainly that spurred my interest. I hadn't been much of a reader up to that point of time. You know, reading to me was a waste of time, as was golf. You should be out doing something else. But that spurred up my interest in reading more about Australia. But I didn't go rushing off to libraries to get books about it.
Well, let's talk more about the voyage. You've described the living conditions.
Mm.
What about the actual routines?
Yeah, it all became quite monotonous. You start off with this very sort of romantic view about what a long ocean voyage is going to be like, you know. And life aboard a big, big ship. And it's quite an exciting prospect, I think, at first. And when we got on board, everybody got on board. Once we'd sort of sailed out of Southampton, you know, and there was nothing, no more of England to look at as such and not much else to look at, then you start to explore the boat and around the decks. And they had games rooms and they had a swimming pool, you know, they had libraries, there were evening movies, there were two two shifts for meals, the standard breakfast, lunch, dinner, standard sort of stuff. And of course, booze and cigarettes were duty free, which made them as cheap as chips, absolutely as cheap as chips, and that was fairly fatal in some respects. But it wasn't difficult to with the four of us in the cabin, we've probably struck up another four blokes from other cabins, and were not too hard to sort of say, well, we'll see you in the bar at 6:30 and have a few sessions. and in some respects it's just as well, because you explore the boat, takes you about 3 hours, and then you know it from sort of top to bottom, and it then all sort of starts to become fairly monotonous. They did have they had trap shooting off the back of the deck, 12 gauge clay pigeons shooting. That was good fun. You had to pay, but it was quite cheap, but that was good fun. And the usual deck quoits and things like that, which I didn't sort of do much of. The conditions were very cramped. There was no, for instance, in the cabin we had there wasn't even a sink. You had to go down quite a lengthy, long walk down a thin corridor to get to the men's toilets and showers. She was quite a cramped boat. But beyond that, we went, I think, I'm fairly sure we put in at Gibraltar, only for a few hours, but that gives you the opportunity to get off, because I've got some old photographs of Gibraltar Rock with all the monkeys all over the place, and I can't recall that I ever been to Gibraltar before or since. It must have been on that voyage, I think. We had a bit of rough weather down the Bay of Biscay, which, it made me a bit queasy. I didn't know whether I'd be a good sailor or not, but it didn't upset me that much. We stopped then at Alexandria, and we got off there and went round Cairo and the pyramids, back on the boat, and then to... Suez up at the top of the canal and Port Said at the bottom?
Yep.
Yeah, so we had an option. You could get off the boat at Suez and go overland down to pick up the boat at Said, or you could stay on board and go down the Suez Canal. And I and the guys in my cabin all decided we'd get off and go overland. I can't really remember much about it. I don't think it was all that exciting, actually. Probably wouldn't have been all that exciting on going sailing down the canal either. Mm-hmm. But we definitely went overland, and I think we just went by bus, and that was it. Anyway, back on the boat again. And then you had this huge haul across the Indian Ocean down to Western Australia. And I was looking up the other day. We crossed the equator on the 31st of March, 1966, because I've got a certificate for that. and I disembarked in Sydney on the 19th of April, 1966. So 19, 20, 21, 22, three days before I turned 19.
Mm-hmm.
Had I actually disembarked after I turned 19, I would have had to shell out the £10 for the assisted passage. £10 assisted passage scheme, but because I was under 19, the Australian taxpayers very kindly paid for the whole thing. And I didn't have to pay my 10 quid. So you had that long, long haul. I don't know exactly how long it would have taken us to get from, and I don't have the date when we left Southampton. I could probably find out somewhere from some shipping records, but it was early in the year.
It was usually about a 6 week
voyage. Yes, usually about a 6 week voyage or something like that. But that big haul, it was, there were some beautiful, bloody beautiful times. We'd see flying fish and dolphins coming up through the water, following the ship, big birds, albatrosses probably, and things like that, magnificent sunsets. The weather, as I recall, it was very kind to us all the way. It was very calm and very pleasant. And it just, you know, you just watch the bow wave or the stern wave just fading away into the distance. That gives you a time to reflect and think, Jesus, what am I doing? What have I done? Have I made a blue? It's still that doubt still sort of grips from time to time when you're in that sort of situation.
What about the food on board?
Yeah, it was all right. There was nothing special about it, but it was all right. It was very English. You know, bacon and eggs and sausage and mash and things like that. It might have been an Italian-owned boat, but they knew they were hauling Pommy immigrants, so they gave them Pommy food. nothing special about it, nothing unspecial about it. Very much actually what I've been used to for 10 years in boarding school. Okay. It was very much boarding school type food. Mm-hmm. Plenty of it. No problem there.
And entertainment? Was there?
Well, just the movies, that was it. They have movies, you know, in one of the lounges each night. I don't think I ever went to any. If I did, I certainly didn't see anything memorable.
What about among the passengers? Were there people with musical instruments who might get together and have a play? Or?
There were people with musical instruments, but I don't remember them getting together and having a play. No, I don't remember that at all. There was nothing too memorable about the trip, other than the fact that it was a long way and it took a long time, and it was basically quite monotonous.
Were there provision for religious services?
Oh yeah. They had church services, which. Yeah, I didn't attend any, but they certainly did. They had Catholic services, Presbyterian services, and C of E services.
Mm-hmm. Were there different nationalities, any other than English?
No, all Brits. Mm-hmm. I mean, these were the sort of halcyon days of the migration from the UK, or getting towards the end of them, albeit, but they were still pulling out. Brits in very large numbers.
Mm, yes. You mentioned, was it Apex who were sponsoring you?
Mm.
Before you left, to what extent had they been helpful? Like, had they been writing to you, giving you advice and that kind of thing?
No, because it was, as I say, they were the formal sponsors, and I think that was to get over the legality of being a sponsor. But I'd had no contact with the Apex Club directly. All the contact I'd had been with Hope. Her name was Hope Stewart. So the Stewart family, and Hope Stewart was Charlie Horsfall's mother's sister, and she and I we exchanged correspondence quite regularly. And I would ask her questions about, you know, what sort of things should I bring, what should I not bring. You know, what do you want me to do and things like that. And she gave me advice on what would, you know, what I'd be doing, and in particular, as the time got closer, what would happen when I got off in Sydney and how I'd get down to Wagga. And she explained the fact that the Apex Club were the formal sponsors. She didn't go into the reasons why, and I didn't ask, I guess. And certainly that I'd be meeting the Apex people when I arrived. So that was really all the communication was with her.
And did it turn out, as she said, were Apex there to actually meet you and take you to Wagga?
No, there's a funny story there. It was all her family and her people that met me. Before we got there, of course, though, we had to go through immigration, which was on the boat off Perth.
Uh-huh.
When the boat stopped at Perth, before anybody could get off, Australian immigration boats, customs and immigration guys came out, and they seemed to be a lot stricter then than they seem to be today. I don't know whether I'm just thinking that, but they were there were no customs guys, it was immigration, and they were, they wanted to know where you'd been, if you'd been off the boat, where had you been off the boat, if you'd been into any area where, you could be in danger of bringing in diseases into the country and all this sort of stuff, and you'd have to get your shoes disinfected if need be, or your clothes, all this sort of stuff. It was quite, broad Aussie accented people, but these guys weren't so gentle. They weren't impolite, but they were very direct. They asked you questions, and they expected straightforward answers. There was no mucking around with these blokes. They were very efficient, and also then coming on board were representatives of the private health funds and the banks, and they were there on board for a couple of days you didn't have to go and see them, but if you wanted to sign up for private health insurance. And this was always one of the frightening things, that you're coming from a country which had a complete national health system, where everything was available for nothing, coming into a country where basically if you didn't have private health insurance and you got into strife, you could be in big trouble. And this had been discussed by the consul guys in Birmingham, and their strong advice was, make sure you get private health insurance, because I signed up, I joined the MBF, so that got that one out of the way. And then the bank was interesting. It was the Bank of New South Wales, and really all they were there, I'm sure they would have opened accounts for you, but I don't think I didn't have enough money to open an account, but I had to change money because at this point everything was going over to Australian currency. And of course the Australian currency had just been decimalised, so literally that month, virtually, or the month before. And these guys, so I was handing over my pommy pounds sterling, and everybody was getting in return these brand spanking new Aussie notes, dollar notes, and they were so colourful. No, none of us ever seen money this bright. You had your blue $10 notes and your orange 20s and the green $2 notes and the brownish sort of $1 note, but they were all crispy, brand new. And of course, we've got so many of them. All of a sudden, you felt you were rich because the exchange rate was pretty good. And that was quite a novelty, these crisp notes. You really didn't want to spend any of them because they were just so beautiful. And then the boat docked at Fremantle. People getting off there got off, and they got hit with customs. We hadn't got hit with customs. We then sailed on, and it stopped at Adelaide, and it stopped at Melbourne, and finally got to Sydney, to Pyrmont. I got off the boat at Pyrmont.
Before you talk about disembarkation there, Fremantle would have been your first sighting of Australian.
Yeah.
Of Australia.
Yeah.
Do you recall the impression?
It was it was not very impressive in a way, because Fremantle was nothing more than the port, basically. It wasn't a very attractive place. The trains, we saw a couple of trains, might have even taken a train into Perth, but it was a very old-fashioned sort of a train. Everything seemed sort of behind, like 5-10 years behind what things were like in the UK, which didn't concern me. I sort of thought it was quite quaint. We went to a pub in Fremantle, the pubs really were a big shock to the system, ultimately. but that's about all. It wasn't a hugely impressive impression, if you like. But as I say, it didn't sort of disturb me. I think if I thought about it at all, I would probably have thought it looks a bit like an American town, with the awnings and sort of almost boardwalks along the shops and things. So, but we weren't there long, of course. I mean, basically, we're only there probably a couple of hours, 2 or 3 hours, enough to get people off, unload their baggage and get them off and then get going again. The boat never spent much time anywhere. its one mission in life was to get these buggers over there as fast as possible.
you mentioned the trunk that you had with you. Mm. Apart from clothing, what else did you bring?
I had my collection of Johnny Cash albums, which numbered then only about 6, because that's about all I had. But that's another thing my brother did for me. He gave me an LP of Johnny Cash, Ride This Train, which had the front cover of Cash standing on top of a big hill with a big old American Western steam engine chunking along down in the background, and here he is dressed up as a cowboy loading a 6-gun, right. You know, and he's singing all these Western songs. I was a mad fan of cowboys and Indians, if you like, and I had been since childhood, and so have my brother. And in some respects, that's one area where I'm digressing backwards a bit, but where he was really good, because when I wanted to play cowboys and Indians, he, at 5 years older than me, had probably got past it. But he still played with me, you know, and he was wonderful. But he gave me this Johnny Cash album. I'd never heard of Johnny Cash in my life, and I really liked it. So I started to look around, and I found a few more. So I have, to answer your question, that was one thing I had there. I had a couple of books. I have my book on Cooper's Creek, a few other things, clothes, and a few bits and pieces that you might regard as your favourite bits and pieces. I had a fountain pen and a pencil that had been my father's. I had a couple of things that had been my mother's keepsakes, not much else.
After Fremantle, did you stop at Adelaide at all?
Yeah, but again, very briefly, because they must have done, because immigrants were getting off in all ports. And they got off in, quite a few got off in Fremantle, quite a few got off in South Australia, because from that point on the boat was nearly empty, or, you know, half empty. All of a sudden there was all the room in the world. They didn't take anybody on board when they dropped them off. But I don't remember spending any time in Adelaide. And again, you know, it might very well have been if there was 100 people getting off in Adelaide, they probably would have shoveled them off in an hour and got their baggage off in an hour and got going again. Likewise, Melbourne.
You mentioned the group of young men who you became friendly with. Did you mix much generally with other passengers?
Yes and no. Yes. I mixed with a whole, probably quite a large number of them, but only in a pretty casual, polite sort of fashion. And again, probably because I was so young, most of these people were families. I didn't sort of get into discussions with people about where are you going, what are you going to do. I certainly would have done with those 4 guys in the cabin. We would have talked about what we were going to do. I remember saying to one of them, they were all staying in it. I think 1 or 2 got off in Melbourne, and the others in Sydney. They're all going to stay in the cities. One was a motor mechanic, I think. One was a brickie. One was in the printing trade. They were all in the trades. So, you know, and I don't think any of them had any jobs lined up as such, but they had the trades and they were all quite happy to, you know, they decided, well, I'm going to stay in Melbourne or I'm going to stay in Sydney and I'll get work there. They thought I was mad. They'd never heard of Wagga. Neither had I until I first sort of started to get an interest in the whole scheme anyway. But they thought I was completely nuts, you know, going out to the middle of nowhere, you know. Then we coming into Sydney, the officers on the boat made the point that we'd be sailing into Sydney Heads at about 5 o'clock in the morning, and that it really is worth getting up and watching us, because we're watching the approach to, and as we sail under Sydney Harbour Bridge, which is something I really wanted to see, because, you know, this is the iconic vision of Australia, particularly then. Didn't have an opera house in those days. And so I, yes, got up, and we came in through the Heads, and it was a magnificent morning, a beautiful sunrise. And you sort of round the harbour bit there, and you start to see Sydney Harbour Bridge. And at first it's off in the distance, and it looks like a matchbox toy. And you slowly get closer and closer and closer to it. And as we got closer to it, I was still disappointed. I thought, this bloody thing's tiny. You know, I thought it was massive. I thought it was a huge thing. And I was quite disappointed at how seemingly small it looked. I still wonder at it to this day. Whenever I go over Sydney Harbour Bridge, I still think what a magnificent structure it is. And of course, I now realise it's actually a hell of a lot bigger than it might look from the water. but that first sight of it was a complete shock. Complete shock. It didn't concern me, it didn't worry me, but I just thought, oh, Jesus, that's nothing like as big as it ought to be. And we sailed under it and docked at the Pyrmont Finger Wharves, just nearby. Everybody piled off, and you had to hang around and wait until your baggage was offloaded.
Can you describe for me, sorry to interrupt, what was the scene like at the wharves as the boat came into the wharf? I guess you would have been looking out at the wharf.
Everyone was looking out and watching it, you know, being pushed to the side of the wharf and the tugs there and all of that. It didn't take too long to get organised, and we got off quite quickly. And once you got off, it was a two-storey warehouse, basically. You got off on the second storey, and you got... a lot of people had people there, you know, waving placards for names and things like that to get families together and all of this sort of business, or passengers. And then you had to wait to get downstairs to identify your hold baggage and then stand by it and wait until a customs official came across, and they'd go through your baggage. And again, they were there was no mucking about with them either. You know, the bloke came up to me and said, right, you know, this yours? Yes, sir. Yeah. Okay, open it up. Yeah, you open it up. Right, what do you got in here? Boom, boom, boom. And that's where he looked at the Johnny Cash records and said, I don't think he was too impressed. And I had a few other records there too. And he was I probably had in all, I don't know, a dozen or 20 albums, you know, big 33 albums. And he pulled everyone out to check that there was no, illegal music, banned music coming in. He looked at all of those quite closely. He went through everything quite closely and said, righto, thanks very much, you know, good luck. And off he went to the next bloke. Now, I got met by a relative of Hope Stewart's. I think he was her brother, who lived in Sydney, lived in Hornsby. And I had a day in Sydney, and he helped me get, we got my trunk taken over to, we got that over to Central Station, and that was put in the left luggage area, so we didn't have to cart it all the way up to Hornsby. And then we went by train up to Hornsby, and I stayed a night there with them, and then he brought me back and dropped me back at Central Station the next day. And then he had to go to work, and I left me for a few hours, it was, before the train left. couple of things, I suppose. You know, you sort of ask about impressions.
Yes.
Well, the Red Rattler was an eye-opener. I loved the Red Rattler. I thought, this is absolutely bloody wonderful. Here we are, and it was hot in the, you know, February. Where are we now? March. No, we're not. We're April. It was still pretty warm anyway. But here we are rattling along in a train with the doors wide open. I'd never been on a train with the doors open before. I thought, it's absolutely fantastic. The other thing that really struck me was men's clothes. Men in Sydney, you know, particularly suits, because as I said, we wore suits at school. I'd been used to wearing a suit. If I'll just for a second take you back to the school time, when you were a prefect or a sixth former, and I was a house prefect for the last 12 months at school or so, but when you were there, you could go and get your own suit tailor-made. Now, the school uniform was a college grey suit, but when you were a house prefect, you could get a charcoal grey suit, almost black, and you could get it tailor-made. Guys got these things tailor-made with flash red, gold, or royal blue lining in the jackets. Pockets that sort of go down the front of the trousers instead of the side. And of course, as I say, Beatles period time, almost drain pipe trousers, not quite, but certainly narrow trousers, no cuffs on the bottom of the trousers. All of a sudden, walking down Sydney, here were guys wearing hats that were sort of 1950s trilbies and suits that looked like they came out of the 50s.